This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Welcome to the Hope Centre, where real stories meet real conversations about mental health, growth and hope. I'm Anna, and we're here to share, connect and remind you that you're not alone. Let's dive in. Welcome to the Hope Centre podcast, a project put together by Life Matters Suicide Prevention Trust with the help of ORFM and Anytime Fitness in Dunedin. If you have any topics that you'd like us to cover or are interested in being a guest on the podcast, please reach out to us on our Facebook page or email admin@lifematters.org.nz. Kia ora, I'm Anna.
And kia ora, I am Will. I am back again, filling in for Omri as he takes a break, a well-deserved one.
Yes, so we're still not in our usual team. I think it's been a couple of episodes where things have been a bit strange, but in a good way.
Yeah, a bit of difference, but you know, we're figuring it out as we go.
Yeah, it's been nice to connect with various other people. And while the vibes are a bit strange with podcasts at the moment, the topic's really exciting today. Today we are talking to an author, former local government representative, a survivor of complex trauma and an avid Lego fan, Robin Parkinson. Welcome to the Hope Centre podcast.
Kia ora, very excited to be here. We were just talking about being avid podcast listeners and then making the switch to being a podcast host, or in my case, this is my first ever podcast interview. And I'm like, oh, it genuinely is exciting. Yeah. Like, I just thought they all just said that for something to say.
Yeah, it's exciting. Yeah,
so thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a bit of a switch, but you know what? In 2 weeks' time, you'll be able to listen to it back and hear yourself on a podcast if you want. I don't like listening to my own voice, but that's just me. I'd love to invite you to introduce yourself, who you are, what brings you here today.
Thank you. So I was reflecting as I flew in this morning from Wellington that it's been almost exactly 40 years since I last flew into it to Dunedin as a Scarfie. I've spent 5 years in Dunedin, and I've come back at times. So still a real sense of connection to the place, staying with friends who was catching up because he's a former flatmate and reminiscing about his former flatmate, Nigel Latter, and, you know, as you do, all kinds of things. Special place, Dunedin.
Is it as you remember?
I haven't had a real good look around. I've just gone in this morning. I've been back over the years. Interestingly, when I looked it up, the Hope Centre is right next door to the building I got married in.
Oh, my goodness.
In 1990.
In the church building?
Yeah, the old Hanover Street Baptist. Mm-hmm. So, those are my connections to Dunedin, but I've lived for the last 35 years in Wellington. There was a period up until 2022, I had 6 years on local government, which the very lowest level of local government, I'm talking community board level, and I'd become the chair, and I was going to, I was fairly sure of winning, and I was told by people, which is silly, you never know anything in politics, I was told by people I would win. So I had a lot of expectations set up, and I lost the election in 2022. So that set off effectively a complete breakdown. Very sudden, very severe, very like, what the hell is going on and how are we going to deal with this? And I felt that I had, it was very obvious very early on, it was very severe and it was very much, I've got trauma symptoms. I knew almost nothing about trauma. I had some vague idea about what PTSD was. I thought that's something you get from going to war or, you know, some real big event. And I was like, I've just lost an election. Like, that doesn't count. What's going on? Mm-hmm. I had no concept of complex trauma, which apparently as a concept in even Western writing has basically been around since 1992. Mm-hmm. So it's not exactly a new concept, but it was a very new concept to me.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, to just about, not absolutely everybody, but most people I came into contact with in trying to get support. So from a very early stage, I thought, I don't believe what's happening to me. I need to write it down as a record for myself. And then very soon after that, a friend was saying, Robin, you're learning so much. You need to write it down for the, you know, this will benefit somebody else at some point. So that's how the book started, was me writing down notes about my journey as it was going along. And every now and again it'd just be, oh my God, I don't believe that happened, but at least it's a good steam for the book. You know? Yes. It's just a terrible thing to live through, and I'm still living. I'm not at the end of the journey. I'm not healed.
Mm-hmm.
The book is not a neat, tidy self-help book. Mm-hmm. It's a complex trauma memoir. It's called Give Me a Memory, a Complex Trauma Memoir. Because I wanted complex trauma to be front and center. I'm not nationally famous.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, you know, I was never going to get the kind of attention that a memoir normally does in New Zealand.
Mm.
Yeah. So interesting route mm-hmm. to effectively becoming a publisher as well as an author, and hiring the consultants and the editors and the mm-hmm. designers, all that kind of thing. Very interesting trying to get it. You know, you've got the initial hurdle of, can I get into a bookshop?
Yeah.
And then, can I get some coverage? Because this book is effectively, obviously about me, but that's not the main purpose. The main mm-hmm. purpose is, I feel like I've learned a lot. And one of the things I've learned a lot is the power of storytelling. I was really interested in a previous mm-hmm. podcast you guys did, I think with Voices of Hope,
mm-hmm.
who talked about the power of storytelling.
Yes, yeah.
And it's just so powerful as a survivor of anything psychologically distressing
mm-hmm.
to connect with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to give that gift to whoever was wanting to read it, basically.
Yeah. Wow.
That's the journey that's led me here.
Mm-hmm. It's a really brave and a really quite vulnerable thing to do, is to put everything you've experienced in some pages, right? But, you know, what I'm hearing is something we talk about in the Hope Centre is the concept of living experience. And while we may have processed and been through a lot of the stuff that we've been through, there is still always more to go.
Oh, yes.
It's a never-ending story.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Always continuing.
And that in itself was a really hard thing to come to terms mm-hmm. with. I opened the book with a scene of basically saying, I want to be fixed mm-hmm. right now.
Yeah.
Like, this was only several months post-breakdown, mm-hmm. and I was desperate to be, I'm using air quotes, fixed.
Yeah.
Because
that's
what I thought I was. I thought I was broken. I had no idea what was going on and what the process mm-hmm. ahead would be. And, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
really tough, really, really tough place to be in. Tough for the people around me.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, the various parts of the health system are just terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Utterly terrible to deal with. So.
No, a very exciting and a very brave thing to do, to kind of put all your thoughts into something that other people can have access to. It takes mm-hmm. a lot of strength, mm-hmm. hey?
It wouldn't be everybody's thing. You know, I wouldn't want to put expectations on anybody else. Like, you're healed, so you can go out and write a publisher. Like, mm-hmm. that's going to be quite rare.
Yeah.
But I think for those of us, like, I love writing.
Yeah.
And I knew I had a skill at writing. Mm-hmm. And I just knew mm-hmm. from very early on, this is a story I need to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm already getting feedback that that's helped other survivors,
mm-hmm.
helped other professionals mm-hmm. to understand. Recently had a chat with a GP, and I asked, well, what's your take on it? What did you get out of it? Mm-hmm. And their comment was, my description of how I was dealt with by health services was really useful, because as a GP, for example, you only see a little small snippet mm-hmm. of it. You don't see the sort of following trail of chaos mm-hmm. until it comes back into your office.
Yep.
But also they said, very wonderfully, they are actually quite trauma-informed, but not from their education, mm-hmm. not from their medical knowledge, from another avenue. And they said, well, I saw myself 10 years ago with my level of knowledge doing the same things and re-traumatizing you.
Yeah.
And so it's just not widespread knowledge. That's what blew mm-hmm. me away. It's just not well known enough.
Mm-hmm.
In your book, Robin, Give Me Memory, you talk about caring for not only yourself, but also your wider whānau. You describe that much of this care was unhelpful and re-traumatizing. How would you like to have been treated to avoid such re-traumatization?
What a question.
Yeah, I think that links into what you were just describing with your conversations with GPs. And, you know, something I note when you say that is, we support a lot of people in the Hope Centre, and this is a really common, unfortunate experience.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That lack of trauma-informed lens to best support someone to recovery.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I feel like I'm actually going to spend the rest of my life answering this question, or helping mm-hmm. to answer this question. This is an ongoing process. So I'm not an expert. I mean, my degree's undergraduate or in philosophy and law. I've ended up doing a few papers postgraduate in public health, which has helped put that kind of lens on it. Mm-hmm. But so this comes from very much a lived experience point of view. And there's a couple of levels I could talk about it at. So as you said, trauma-informed is the biggest thing. And for some people, that'll just be like a buzzword or a something trendy or whatever. But it's for anyone who knows about it, it's not. And you guys will understand that, I'm sure. And so when I say trauma-informed, there's some basic principles that that normally implies. Mm-hmm. One of the base things is simply the ability to recognize that almost anyone who walks in your door as a service could be traumatized. It's way more widespread. It's not just PTSD. It can be intergenerational trauma. It could be historical trauma, particularly if you've got Māori in your whakapapa, which I don't. But, you know, there's any number of avenues that trauma can come into your life. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things I wanted to get across in my book is I've got a very particular source, I guess. I source most of my trauma symptoms from emotional neglect in childhood, which is a very neglected field, basically. Yeah. Most people write about, if they're going to write about their childhood and it was bad, they write about the physical abuse or the sexual abuse or those kind of more obvious or have become more obvious to us as a society, but emotional neglect we're still catching up on. So the trauma-informed lens is kind of just the very first baseline is this person walking in could be traumatized and not know it.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I discovered, and I describe this in the book, I have what's called white coat syndrome. Mm-hmm. I can walk into a doctor's office as calm as a cucumber on the outside, and they put a blood pressure cuff on me and it's high.
Yeah.
And then we have to wait another 5 minutes and, oh, surprise, surprise, it's a bit lower because I've been spent time talking to that person and I've interacted and I've, what the psychologist would call, co-regulated with that person. Mm-hmm. And I've calmed down and my blood pressure's gone down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those have real-world implications when you're actually dealing with a service, with a health service, if they're in a rush, if they don't have the time to do the second reading or the whatever. And that's just that one tiny, you know. So another thing I came across when doing some research for an assignment for university, there is research that indicates that, and I'm not anti-antidepressants or medication as a generic thing. Like, everyone's individual.
Yeah.
Totally want to put that out there. I personally know through experience and through a whole bunch of other things, they're not for me. But I also found research that shows that antidepressants aren't actually anywhere near as effective for people with childhood trauma.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when I say to people that fact, and then I follow it up with, and how many times do you get asked at a health service about your childhood? And everyone goes, huh? So it's that concept that particularly what happens in childhood has there's been decades of research. There's a massive association between multiple layers of stress in childhood and the likelihood, not the certainty, but the likelihood is much greater of poor health, poor social outcomes later in life.
Mm-hmm.
Unquestionable. That association is now, I would say, unquestionable.
Yeah.
To the point where the state of California, for example, is actually screening for it, which is another whole issue. Mm-hmm. Like screening on individual level is a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
So on the bigger level, it's the awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Awareness that trauma is not just PTSD. Complex trauma is a thing. Mm-hmm. And then the principles of safety and trust and empowerment, choice, collaboration, having a sense of agency as the person coming in rather than things being done to you. Questions like the what happened to you questions rather than the what's wrong with you questions, which tend to lead in the wrong direction for trauma. The whole recognition that a mind-body split that's behind a lot of our biomedical Western approach potentially that dominates most health services in New Zealand, probably not the Kaupapa Māori ones, I would hope, but most of the rest that I've experienced, that's very evident. You've got a mental health issue and you're at that little building at the other side of the car park. You don't go through the main entrance of the hospital. It's as concrete as that. And yet it affects all of you. So, you know, that knowledge that it affects all of you. I think for me specifically, there's some... Everyone's going to be a bit different, but being treated as a person, definitely. The biggest trigger, one of the hardest things for me was anytime there was a form.
Yeah.
know, if they've wanted to treat me in a bureaucratic way,
yeah, right, the overwhelming process of filling out forms and
yeah, or want to look me up on the system and just ask for my last name, not my first name.
Yeah.
I'm kind of I'm a person with a first name.
Yeah.
I come in a very vulnerable state to the service, and you don't even want to know my first name at the desk. Those kind of things.
Because I think, something we often talk about at the Hope Centre, one of the first things we always say, it's so hard to walk through those doors sometimes.
Yes.
And when that's not met with an appreciation of how hard just that alone is, it can be very jarring.
Yes, yeah. And to be clear, there's no similar peer support service that I'm aware of in Wellington, so I didn't have that option, sadly. But in the book I describe reaching out to helplines, for example, and some were good. And some were very mixed, and some were just the whole litany of questions right off the bat, you know, tell me your name, age, demographic, where you're from, blah, 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 and like, what?
It's almost like a checklist of
I'm barely, you know, I'm so badly off, I can't even ring you, I'm literally texting you.
Yeah.
I can't answer that barrage of questions, you've just shut down the channels of communication, so...
And there's so much research on the brain and how the brain works and processes under distress. And all that indicates is so that's not actually really an appropriate nor helpful way to interact with someone in that state. But as you said, so many points that you've just listed there with, you know, being given agency, being treated on a humanistic level all speaks really truly to the way that an intentional peer support model works.
Yeah,
and it, again, just reinforces that thought of, if this was widely accessible everywhere, how much different would the world be? We just don't know.
Yeah. Massively different, I think. And the other interesting point I want to pick up on, and unfortunately this was with Omri, who's not here today, and their emails back and forth, but he talked about, I was talking about, like we're just saying now, that trauma-informed feels a lot like what you're talking about with peer support. And he commented that peer support wasn't originally meant to be a service as such, but was an intentional thing out in the community. And I thought, well, that's another layer. So there's a layer of how would I like to be treated by the health services as a traumatized person. But then there's also a societal layer of having a level of knowledge and acceptance of a range of things. To be able to talk about some things is almost impossible because there's so much fear and so much ignorance. And yet... the level of trauma is so prevalent and so underknown, under-recognised that okay, so an Australian NGO that I mention in my book called the Blue Knot Foundation, they are set up to support adult survivors of complex trauma. They've been going under that guise for 10 years. They previously morphed out of a sexual abuse support group. Okay, so their estimate is that 1 in 4 adult Australians have complex trauma.
Wow.
1 in 4.
Yeah.
Quite high statistics.
Can you imagine if 1 in 4 New Zealanders approach the mental health services for help?
Oh, well, that's, you know, it's overloaded enough and we don't have the resources. And I think the amount of people that really need resources is so high and it becomes a bit of an impossible situation. Well, not impossible to solve, but it's about getting those resources, funding those programs and making sure help is available, you know, and that kind of recovery-orientated, people-orientated, you know.
And with the limited resources, the last thing we want to be doing is making people worse when they come to them.
Yeah, exactly.
No, we can't be wasting that kind of money. We're a small country.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. Some key themes noted throughout your book are resilience, determination, and perseverance. I'm curious what helped you what you feel helped build your resilience while managing your own distress?
This is another really good question. I don't want this to come across as a self-help guru or someone who knows it all. That's the exact opposite of what I want to come across as. Because, yes, there are individual things I did that helped, but they might not help somebody else.
Absolutely.
And also... resilience to me is not just, the more I think about it, the more it's not just this individualistic thing.
Yep.
Well-being is not just about what I do.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the connections I have and the wider resources I have and what family and friends do I have around me.
Mm-hmm.
So I say in the book, I've got a section at the end of my book when I talk about a privileged life of trauma because, I mean, despite all the privilege I have, I still was traumatized, but I'm one of the lucky ones because I've got, I mean, I've been married for 35 years, 36 years next month. I've been married for quite a while. I was, you know, a strong, supportive relationship with my husband. Yes, it took him a few months to get his head around how to support someone who's traumatized, but he's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. I've got four grown-up kids, and they've been supportive. I've got close friends that I've built up over the years, and they've been amazing. But I'm very conscious. I go on to, you know, forums like Reddit or Facebook with support groups for traumatized people, and gosh, the number of people on there who are traumatized, and they don't have anybody. So I don't want to come across as someone who's like, look, I did all these resilient things and I managed to write a book and, you know, me. That's not the case. I had a lot going for me anyway. So they result from my environment, and they're also kind of not cognitive things. They're not sort of, I'm thinking a particular way and therefore it's helping me kind of thing. So, I don't know, we've got a cat. Having a pet's well known to be help you to be resilient. We've got a cat. And then I came across Ajax, who sadly the listeners can't see unless they jump on Facebook and see me or something, but he's my stuffed toy dog husky.
Yes,
and
he's very cute.
He's amazing to carry around. He gets great interactions from people, and that helps my resilience. I'm fortunate to be in a reasonable financial position as a household. So, you know, some people would have the pressure to have to earn money while trying to recover. I don't know how that works. Like, it's a full-time job as far as I can see. Trying to source help, trying to do the work to, you know, help make things better. Yeah, all that's pretty tricky. I think, but on an individual basis, some things looking back that have helped over the last few years is having a purpose or a goal, which I certainly didn't feel like that to start with, but once I got the idea in my head of writing a book, that was hugely helpful. It gave me something outside the whole process. And it also gave me a place to park everything. Like, I was like, I've written up the notes today and that's going in the book later. And I don't have to revisit it quite yet. So that was one.
That really makes me think of one of the principles of peer support, the final task of, more so the task I'm moving towards, and that's something we're always trying to instill is what can we look forward to in the future and some kind of thing we can strive towards, and that can look in many different ways.
And acknowledging that when you're in the deepest, darkest places of emptiness, that can feel impossible. Like, I'm not saying I always had a sense of purpose, but when I did have it, when I was able to sense that sense of purpose, it was incredibly helpful. Creativity in other ways, like you've mentioned, I'm a great Lego fan. The year I was looking for support, so the first half of my book effectively, that was not going well, to put it mildly. And I was in and out of trying to find different therapy, and I thought, oh, blow it. I'm just going to buy myself a decent Lego set. I'm just going to remake one of the ones I've got from years ago. Oh, wow, I've forgotten how much I enjoyed it. I'll go and buy another one. And I was part of a adult club. They're called user groups, Lego user groups. So I've been part of the Wellington one since not long after it first started, over 10 years ago. And so we do shows once a year. So we show out what we've done to the public, and that's an amazingly creative thing. But also for someone who's traumatized, one of the things about trauma is that you desperately, complex trauma, you desperately need to be seen, but you're also scared of it in a way, in some form or other.
It's multiple truths.
So it was a way to interact with people that felt very safe. I could show my Lego. They were all excited about it. We would talk about the Lego. It was something different than what was going on all the other days of my year, you know. So
it's special.
That was, again, not everyone's going to have access to, you know, particularly to do a show. Lego at quantity is not cheap. But but it's a lot of fun. And you can, even at small scale, you can have a lot of fun. I'm not a Lego salesperson.
This is not a Lego promotion.
Not Lego promotion. Get no money from this, sadly. No free Lego set here.
Well, I think you've hit various important points there. Firstly, that, you know, the concept of purpose and feeling purposeless. I know this is something that we see quite frequently in the mental health system, and helping people find that purpose is quite important. But it takes its time to find something that's going to make life feel worth it almost and to feel motivated, but also the concept of resilience lying in community and lying in what's around you, which again links into those holistic models of well-being that we tend to follow and use in intentional peer practice.
Yeah, so, definitely.
Very important points there. And we've got a couple more questions that we would love to ask you, but before we do so, we will just jump to a quick ad break from our sponsor.
At Anytime Fitness Dunedin, our mission is to raise the self-esteem of the world. A healthy lifestyle doesn't start and stop at the gym. It starts with a plan, which is why we offer solutions that incorporate fitness, nutrition, well-being, and recovery. With three local clubs to choose from, with 24/7 access, we're certain you'll find your fit. Contact us today to get started. Call 03 455 0013 or visit anytimefitness.co.nz.
Welcome back to the Hope Centre podcast. We've been having a really lovely conversation with Robin, the author of Give Me a Memory, a Complex Trauma Memoir. We've got a couple more questions that we would love to ask, and Will's going to get us into it.
Yes, and now, Robin, I'm curious. How did you find letting people's love in when instincts were saying to push it away or not believe it?
One of the really difficult things about complex trauma is it's so intertwined with personal relationships, because that's where you got traumatized as a kid, typically.
Mm-hmm.
You got trapped in relationships that hurt you rather than nurtured you. So therefore, there is a huge push-away element of your trauma symptoms, if you want to put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard, really, really hard to get around. To the point where I could rationally know, and the evidence is there in front of me. I've got a husband who's not leaving me and kids who are supporting me and friends who are not leaving me. And yet I'd still be having suicidal thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was like, it's a brain melt.
Yeah. Your brain loves to go, but this,
it's just,
but this,
what
but this.
Is going on? This is crazy. So letting it love in, letting any experience of feeling in has actually been, I'm on a journey. It's the only way I can put it. It's actually quite tricky. One of the things I describe in my book, which didn't fulfill everything I wanted it to do, but did actually help with the more extreme parts, was a trauma process that I'd never heard of before called EMDR.
Mm-hmm.
Eye movement desensitization and, I can't even remember what R stands for, realization? Reprocessing. Yeah. That's it.
That's the one.
Yeah, way too long an acronym. EMDR. Fantastic, I think, for more simple PTSD. I'm not downgrading the severity of PTSD when I'm saying simple. I'm just saying it's normally attached to some simpler memories, more discreet, more readily available to you, often as an adult. And if you do EMDR for PTSD, you could, I've heard, do something like half a dozen sessions and have most of your symptoms gone, which is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I did EMDR for 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of those sessions were like a miracle happened.
Yeah.
It was some switch somewhere got flicked inside, and suddenly I could look people in the eye again when I went out in public.
Yeah.
Suddenly I could interact again with people.
What
it was
an
amazing.
Yeah.
But there were things that didn't help.
Yeah.
So I had to move on from that and find something else. And that's not uncommon for people with complex trauma rather than PTSD. Yeah. So there are trauma modalities out there, healing modalities, which are done by trained professionals and can be really helpful. Complex trauma is a long haul.
Yeah.
It's not a short fix. It's not even really a fix. It's retraining your brain from something that helped you survive, which is a really natural, normal mechanism, to something that helps you more in the current situation that you're in. So, it's a slow realization of, not even a realization, a slow embodiment of, okay, I'm getting all this emotional flashback, if you like, from my childhood, but I'm not in my childhood now.
Yeah.
Mm.
I've got kids of my own, and they react totally differently to me than I did to my parents.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a husband, and you know, it's. I can't explain it. It's letting the love in is a really good question, because it was probably one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah.
And definitely I wouldn't want people to be put off by reading my book and thinking, oh, I'm not going to reach out for help. Because, yeah. You know, you got to take pieces of the help that actually work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would recommend EMDR for most people with trauma, potentially if they can access it. But again, in New Zealand, that can be.
And I can even speak, in my own personal lived experience, I've undergone EMDR therapy myself. And it, for me, was unbelievable. It was a very long process. I'm still actually doing it, I've done most of it now, and it was an unbelievable process. I was quite skeptical at first, you know, like, oh, really? Am I going to be looking at a therapist doing their fingers back and forth? Is that really? And then I remember after my first session of it, thinking, whoa, this actually has really brought up some stuff, and that kind of physical feeling and the feelings of my body and sensations and noticing that, and I think it's one of those things, for some people, it can be unbelievably helpful, right? But as many things in mental health journeys, everyone's journey is going to be their own. And it's about finding what works for you, and sometimes a bit of trial and error. And that's the thing. Some things work unbelievably well for some people, and for some, it just means you've got to find something different. It doesn't mean it's not available, but it just might take a bit more searching.
And that's a hard part of the process. It is hard to definitely. Keep going and keep persevering. That's not straightforward.
It's a not linear journey at all.
No.
Ups and downs, hey? Cool. In your own upbringing, you described not having many spaces to talk about how you were feeling. How did you negotiate the creation of those spaces as you were creating your own family?
Again, a really fascinating question. Mm-hmm. I'd like to preface this by saying there's no such thing as a perfect parent.
Absolutely.
Particularly with what I'm about to say about what my kids have fed back to me. I'll start with what they said. I asked them a similar question, and one of them said, Mum, you always checked in with us after school. Mm-hmm. There was a structure of, I knew when I came home you'd be checking in how we were. It was that kind of containing making a space intentionally. It was like intentionally checking in on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Two of them said that they were never afraid to ask questions. They felt safe, which is pretty much essential to creating a place where they can talk about how they feel about what's going on at school or whatever. So a lot of that was me being around, but it was also me being... If I had a goal for being a parent, it was that one day when my kids grew up, if they so chose, we could have a relationship. Mm-hmm. Because deep down, I was trying not to really face it, but I knew that I didn't have a relationship with my parents.
Yeah.
And I knew that's what I did not want for my kids. I wanted my kids to have at least the ability to choose to have a relationship with me at some point when they're adults, if they wanted. I think actually it starts with, it starts with a lot of actually quite pre-verbal stuff, not even talking about feelings. So a baby's so helpless when they come out. They can't do anything. All they can do is cry to let you know, what does that cry mean?
Yeah.
Does it mean
this?
Yeah, it's got this list of things.
Yeah.
When I had my second baby, my oldest was not quite two, and baby started crying, and the eldest started piping up, eat, sleep, poo.
Yeah.
I'd obviously talked enough out loud about what the various cries might mean and what that baby might need, that their older sibling knew what the list was. And that kept on just growing and growing with time. And I think so it's part of that focus on what does that child need of me now? Mm-hmm. What does that child as an individual child, all four quite different? You know, if there was a tantrum, to take it to the preschool years when they're starting to talk, if there's a tantrum when they're out shopping, I realized very quickly that it actually wasn't their problem, it was mine. I had to change the way I was doing things. So in my case, I went, okay, I need to buy a tandem pram. They're obviously walking along too far. Mm-hmm. I've pushed them beyond their limits, so I need to change something to make their environment better for them, which ends up being better for me as well. But yes, it's that it's that not, you know, turning around and yelling at them, turning around and disciplining them for having a tantrum because they're tired in a public space. Yeah. That, you know,
it's an expression of an emotion, and that emotion, while it might be having a tantrum is not necessarily a bad thing. It's an expression of some need, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, they're expressing a need. What's the need? What's what's going on here? And then the other key thing is down the years as they got older, if I made a mistake, I tried to own it. Sometimes that would take years. I'm going to be honest. Sometimes I made a mistake and it was years later. But that creates a sense of safety because they see that if they've got an issue with you, you might be able to deal with it. Whereas my experience with my parents, I don't remember my parents apologizing about anything. I remember my aunt apologizing once about blowing up, and I was blown away. I mean, adults apologized.
That's crazy.
What a wild thought. So that's important. Also, the other thought I had was I did a lot of explaining to my kids. They probably got sick of it, but it's a, I thought it's a bit like what paramedics do. They're constantly explaining what they're about to do and why. And that's part of being trauma-informed. It creates a safe container where there's that calm, measured voice. When they get a certain level of language, which is quite early on for some kids, they've got an idea of what might be happening or why it might be happening. They at least understand that you're the calm, measured voice and you seem to know what's happening and got some degree of control over it. You're conveying more than just what's behind the words with your words, if you want to say like that. So, again, I don't remember getting very many explanations, if any, at all as a kid. And I think that's my generation.
And you think about how important that is to, from an early age, be shown how you do have agency, you do have control, you are allowed to be informed about the things that are happening. Links into a conversation we had, long story short, peers are going into the ED to kind of support with the mental health presentations they get there. And we had a conversation with one of the nurses this week about being trauma-informed and, okay, I'm going to put this here and this is why I'm doing this. And you just think about how much difference that must make.
Especially in those highly distressed moments when people are coming to the ED, naturally they're going to be in that state. And the ED environment itself isn't not, you know, it adds more distress a lot of the time than tense lights. So anything that is possible to do, I think, can have a huge impact on actually changing the outcome.
Yeah, gosh, must make such a difference, hey, from a young age. I can't imagine it myself, but that's my own lived experience coming in.
Robin, there were many moments of hope in your journey, along with some understandable skepticism. How did you maintain hope while also remaining realistic to keep yourself safe?
Yeah, I got a couple practical things about keeping myself safe. I'll say that at the end of this, but I think it was actually more curiosity than hope. In the darkest places, it was more a what's going to happen next? You know, what's the next chapter in the book? You know, what it was a curiosity more than a hope. I mean, I would have to say at the darkest points in particular, it was very much other people holding hope for me. And the best ones would verbalize that out loud. They would say, look, Robin, I know you can't hope at the moment, but I'm holding hope for you. And that was immensely powerful. It was like, I didn't have the capacity to hope. Just being realistic, I didn't have the capacity to hope at points. On a practical level, when I did, you know, ride the wave and have a somewhat better few days or weeks or whatever, particularly following anything not so good in terms of, at one point my suicidal thoughts moved from being what is described as passive to at one point being active for a number of weeks, which was interesting. And at one point, what really helped was the moment I knew how I might attempt, I also realized I was going to see a friend that day. And I was sitting there making a choice and I thought, I need to be honest with that friend. So I went around and was honest with a friend. That made a massive difference. So there was practical things, and I'm not going to go into any details of what my plan was, but there were certain things I could do once I was in a better space to reduce risk. So I identified, okay, I know how now, which is terrible. I should never have got to that point. But I know how now, which means I know where my weak points are. And there are things I can do. I can give things to other people. So there was two friends who ended up with stuff in locked cupboards or whatever. You know, it was just being really deeply practical and reaching out to people with, this is something practical you can do for me. I'm being, you know, being vulnerable and saying, this is a weak point for me. It may not look like it at the moment, but that's why I'm being able to reach out to you and reduce my risk. So it took time to get to that point. I couldn't actually even, the word suicidal couldn't even get past my lips when I first had the conversation with my husband, for example. We're not good at talking about suicidal thoughts as a society, I found, from my experience. Don't know about yours.
Oh, no, I think being in the workplace that we are, it is so much more common. But even like extending to my other social circles and stuff, it is something that's really hard to talk about. And I relate to that. Another long story short, but in I had a concussion last year, and part of the concussion recovery process was getting an occupational therapist and doing the lists and the forms and the surveys. And one of them was like, I had my partner with me as a support person and was like, have you experienced suicidality before? And I was like, I've been with this person for like 4 or 5 years, but I don't know if I've explicitly said this out loud yet, but it really changed the way that we were able to talk about it in the future. But what I'm hearing is that there is obviously a lot of trust between you and these people. You felt safe enough in these relationships in order to give means or to do whatever you needed to do at that time.
When I was in a good point,
when you're at a good point.
It didn't feel possible at times. And certainly not in the early months when everything just felt like chaos and emptiness and hopelessness. So I wouldn't want to portray that that's easy either.
Definitely not.
But it's one thing I learned again from the research, I'm a bit of a research nut, is that risk prediction is not best practice. It's very hard to predict who's going to do what.
Absolutely.
Very hard. So the best practice is to reduce risk. And when I realized that risk reduction approach wasn't really coming from the professionals that I was approaching, I thought, well, I'll have to do it myself. DIY, risk reduction. I've got that agency. Not easy conversations to have at all. Not easy. Sure. But I would hope that the more of us who talk about it, the easier I hope it gets for other people to talk about it.
That's the goal, hey? Because mental health recovery often isn't linear, how do you maintain hope that you're still on the right track?
Sometimes that's just feedback from other people.
Yeah.
The people around me. Sometimes it's me looking back a year or two and going, oh, this feels really yuck again. And then something similar happened a year ago, but it actually was worse for whatever reason back then. Or I'm now into my third year of therapy with the same therapist, and I'm seeing a pattern that at the end of every calendar year we have a bit of a bust up somehow. And it's like, okay, I've been through this before, and I don't know what the future holds in terms of me and this particular therapist, but we've been there before. This is the second time around that we've had this, and it's like, okay, I just need to take a deep breath and take a step back, and we trust that we'll be able to either work it out or something, you know. It's that kind of getting perspective. Potentially that's a little bit easier for me because I'm older. I'm in my late 50s, so I've had the experience of a lifetime of ups and downs. How do I know that I'm on the right track? It can be hard. It can be hard. When those things wave back over you and you're like, what? I thought I was beyond all this.
For sure. What I'm hearing is perspective's important. And you're right, a lot of the stuff that we do is, you know, pulling people out and being able to give a different perspective to their experience of what they may be going through. And reflection on that is quite powerful. Hey, being able to reflect and recognize this has happened in these at this time and this time. Could there be patterns here? I've made it through this before. How can I do it again? And perspective.
And
is
having
really
someone say it out loud for you is incredible. So I think that'd be a very powerful part of peer support. It's something that's very powerful when my therapist says it. You realize this is happening, you know. Just verbalizing anything about me that I'm not noticing is incredibly powerful. You feel seen.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Cool. We've got a couple more questions that we would like to ask, but before we do so, we'll just go to a final advert from our sponsor.
Anytime Fitness Dunedin is here to raise the self-esteem of the world. Whether you're new to fitness or getting back into a routine, now's the time to put yourself first. With a supportive community, three local clubs, flexible membership options and access anytime, we're here to help you reach your goals. Get in touch with our friendly team today. Call 03455 0013 or visit anytimefitness.co.nz.
Thanks for listening to the Hope Centre podcast. We've got a couple more questions that we are going to ask Robin just to wrap up the episode as per. I think there's been a couple of episodes without the final five because we've had some repeat guests, so we'll get back into it. But firstly, I just want to say thank you, Robin, for joining us on the podcast. It's been lovely to hear your story, and I think you've got so much knowledge and so much hope to give. And
absolutely.
It's touched me. It's something I'll go back and think about for the rest of the evening. So thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a genuine privilege to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you've got any final thoughts or messages you'd like to share with the audience or for those who may be struggling and listening to this episode.
Sure. I think I want to emphasise what we've already touched on is that thoughts of suicide are way more common than most people realise. I saw a survey and I think it's something like 1 in 4 adults have at least one episode a year of a serious thought of suicide or self-harm. Mm-hmm. That's the most current numbers I found. 1 in 4. That's like quite mind-blowing. It's a very, and again, not wanting to downplay the pain and the impact of suicide itself, but death by suicide is something like 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 11,000 a year. You know the stats better than me.
Mm-hmm.
1 in 4, having thoughts of it is really common.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I'd like to say that having a suicidal thought doesn't mean that we're mad or we're bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, really important. It's been described to me as a clever protective mechanism of the brain. Feels a bit backwards, but that is a clever protective mechanism. But it's also a warning sign that we need more support, that we're overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. It's a brain being overwhelmed and it's trying its best to cope with the uncopeable, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's very common. You're not mad. You're not bad.
Mm-hmm.
You need more support.
Yeah. Beautiful.
And kicking off our final five.
We've got a question to leave. So long story short, again, we usually ask a question left by the final guest at the start of the podcast. However, we forgot. We were too excited and we got into it.
Yeah.
So we'll start with that one.
Sure.
The question was, if you could have a coffee with any person dead or alive, who would it be?
Good question.
I initially went, at this question, and then I went, it'd be a cup of tea, because I'm not a coffee drinker. Very sad, from Wellington, not a coffee drinker. it would be with Jacinda Ardern, without a doubt.
Yeah.
She's gotten a style of leadership I admire. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure she has got an understanding of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched the Prime Minister. I've just started reading her book.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and New Zealand being New Zealand, I know someone who knows her.
Yeah,
I don't think it ever happened. I don't think it ever happened. But, you know, if you're listening, I just wonder, please. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Cool. Now we'll go on to the final five now. There you go.
Thank you. Yeah. Robin, what does well-being mean to you?
What we've touched on already. Mind is body. Body is mind. You can't divide them.
Mm-hmm.
Your environment, your context, your connection with people are all important. I mean, I could be quibble and say, in some senses, I don't quite know what well-being is because I'm still on the journey of recognising the harm done from childhood. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's part of my well-being is facing the grief and the trauma and the hard things.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually part of well-being.
Absolutely.
Just kind of a bit backwards from some of the messages I think we get on well-being these days. Mm-hmm. But you have to face them.
Yeah.
You can't run from them. I'm living proof. They come back to you.
Yeah.
Time does not heal all wounds.
Yeah. Maybe hard to know what well-being is when you've experienced the things that you've experienced. It's kind of shaped your initial ideas about well-being.
Yeah,
it's,
totally.
it's a big part of it is working that out.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you do, aside from Lego, that brings you a sense of calm, balance or peace?
I love playing card or board games with friends.
Yeah.
Even in some really dark days, I wrote one in the book, I played card games with some friends. I went, it was that day. I forgot it was that day that I played 500 with them. It was amazing.
Cool.
My family love playing Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, yes, nice.
I don't get enough of that. That's actually got good research about how therapeutic it is, too.
Yeah.
Quite funny. Creative things, renovation products, projects around the home.
Mm-hmm.
This is all when I can. In the harder times, you can't even put two bits of Lego together the right way. You've got to get realistic about it.
Yeah.
Sometimes these things just don't happen. But
yeah,
it's amazing how often just those simple connection, creative, playful things can really help.
For sure.
Yeah.
Mm. For me, anyway. Yeah. My card game's not everybody's thing.
Yeah.
Or board games. Some people hate
them. Yeah, for sure.
And if you could make one rule that everyone had to follow, what would it be?
That's really simple to answer. I wouldn't.
Oh, yeah?
Not trauma-informed. Sorry. Wouldn't force things on other people, no matter how noble. Couldn't do it. I can't even conceptualise what I thought about it. I know it's a non-answer.
It's not an answer we've had yet, so that's great. It's been like everyone has to walk on the left side of the footpath.
It's been some interesting ones. Yeah. I've listened to it kind of, and what would I say? And it's like, no, I just know.
Yeah.
I can't do it.
Yeah, no, that's so fair enough.
Yeah.
What would you tell your younger self now?
Oh, I describe this in the book. I see your loneliness and your pain, and I'm not going to forget it. It's not going to be forgotten now. It's not going to be walked away from.
Mm.
It was a survival mechanism to walk away from that part of myself and just think that childhood had not had an impact on me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I've needed to literally say that to my younger self.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
I see you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an important relationship, hey, with your younger self.
Yeah.
Cool.
And to wrap up, do you have a question to leave for our next guest on the podcast?
Yes. And in theme with the being trauma-informed, I have two, so they have a choice.
Woo!
So one is, do you have a happy memory from childhood?
Mm-hmm.
And describe it. Or do you have a song that's really important to you and describe that?
Yeah, I like that one. Whoa. I like both of them, that song one. I think it's a great one.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts top of mind?
Oh.
I think I'm going to need to ponder these ones.
I feel like I have about 500 different songs. I think...
At the moment, then.
Yeah, at the moment.
At the moment, what's your song?
Sun Bleach Flies by Ethel Kane, and it's the lyric, I forgive it all as it comes back to me. That I really love, and I think it speaks to me quite a lot in hard times. I've just had to listen to that song and really concentrate on that lyric, and it's really helped my own kind of journey. Mm-hmm. So that's what I would say. Mm-hmm. How about you, Anna?
I'm going to think on this one. See, music and lyrics is something that means a lot to me. I think that's where I find a lot of comfort. So this is going to be a more in-depth answer for me, I fear. I'll bring it next time and you'll have
to
listen.
Did you have any
immediate answers, Robin?
For the song one, yes,
yep.
Definitely. I played at my book launch a song that I'd only just heard in concert 2 weeks earlier by Tammy Nielsen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of her, but I'm not a country music fan, but she's a country music singer based in New Zealand for the last couple of decades, Canadian born. And it's Keep On. And it's very powerful. She's got a very powerful voice. But the story behind it's very powerful, which she tells when she's in concert. So the story was her father, in her early days of trying to make it on the country music scene as a woman, which is, I had no idea how hard that is.
Yeah.
10% of airtime in country music stations on the States is for women and the rest is for
men.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So he encouraged her to keep on, keep on, keep on. And he wrote it down in a letter and she reads that to herself before every show.
Mm.
And so those words of her father come through.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that whole getting encouragement from someone else. It's just that it's a very powerful song. Highly recommend.
What an awesome backstory. Hey, cool. Well, thank you again, Robin, for joining us on the podcast.
You.
It's been lovely to have
Absolutely
you.
Absolutely a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Will, for helping co-host the podcast. Oh. Who knows? You may pop up again. We need to know.
I often do.
Yeah. Actually, now I'm thinking in my head, you probably will. So
there we go.
We'll see. We'll see.
Stay tuned. You're a pro now.
Thank you to ORFM for hosting the podcast once again. To Life Matters and Anytime Fitness for sponsoring the podcast. If you have any ideas for the podcast or wish to be a guest, please reach out to admin@lifematters.org.nz. Thank you. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to our Hope Centre podcast. The most important message we can leave you with today is that it's okay to ask for help and support. You can contact us at Life Matters on 027 240 0114 by phone or text, or send us a message on our Facebook page. You can also contact us through our website. Just look up lifematters.org.nz. You can also drop in to see us at 63 Hanover Street. We're open every day except Mondays. From Wednesday to Sunday, we're open until 9 p.m. If you need support out of those hours, free call or text 1737. If you'd like to listen again or hear other episodes in this podcast, go to oar.org.nz or wherever you get your podcasts. See you soon.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.